It's Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
And as I did foretell, we will tonight be talking once again. We've done this a few times over the earlier months this year, talking once again about political corruption in the state of Illinois, in the city of Chicago. And tonight, a special feature in the suburbs of Chicago. My two guests are Dick Simpson, an old friend, who is the chairman of the Department of Political Science at University of Illinois Chicago, and the source of major research on the extent and the depth and the history of political corruption in our state and town, and David Ellis, who was a lawyer and has been working in the office of Speaker Madigan and was the chief counsel to the Speaker and led the excuse the cough and led the trial before the Senate of Governor Blagojevich. Dick Simpson, you've got a new report coming. What's in it?
Well, what's new in the report is we often pretend that Chicago is a big, bad, evil city and all the corruption is there. What we found is that the corruption is rife in the suburbs as well. We found over 61 suburbs which have corruption or severe conflicts of interest in that form. And we found over 130 individuals who have been convicted of corruption in the recent years in suburbs. So one of the questions has to be, well, how can this be not noticed, and why haven't we done anything about it?
You want to answer your own question?
Well, we didn't notice it because the media doesn't cover very well the suburbs. And when it does, there's an individual story. The usual one is like perhaps Cicero and what's happening in Cicero, and everybody knows a little bit about Cicero. They don't know about the other 60 towns where there's corruption that we've proven. In the case about why we haven't done about anything about it is we haven't really focused on the problem because we thought the corruption problem collectively was either the city of Chicago or maybe the state of Illinois with its four governors who've gone to jail out of the last seven.
Those four governors who've gone to jail, that's the central item in the nation's view of what's wrong with Illinois and of the extent of political corruption in Illinois. And the last one who went to jail and is now just in the beginning of his first year of a 14-year term, I believe, namely Governor Rod Blagojevich, was brought down before he was tried in federal court and convicted, was brought down by being ejected from the governor's office. And the leader of that attempt was our other guest, David Ellis. Was it a hard case to prosecute? I think not.
In some senses, it was difficult because we were not allowed access to very much evidence that the U.S. attorney had. Mm-hmm. And so you were going to trial without a lot of the things that got the governor before the impeachment tribunal to begin with. The tapes. I wanted the tapes. I wanted all these witnesses who were in cahoots with him. We were denied most of that. And so we were essentially going on the allegations against him from the criminal complaint. And we were trying to make the case that these are serious charges and the governor won't even come and answer them. And if you can't even answer the charges, you shouldn't be able to look the 13 million people in the state of Illinois in the eye and say, you know.
The trial before the Senate started.
Yeah.
He was not there. He didn't have any legal representation there. He was in New York on that show with the four or five rather opinionated ladies.
Yeah, he was in New York telling everybody what a sham we were and how unfair we were. Yeah. And we were doing our best to give him as much fairness and due process as we could.
It's a small matter. It will pass, but inevitably it is of some psychological interest and some human interest. What do you two guys make of what was wrong with Blagojevich and how he messed up so fully and so deeply? To be sure, Governor Ryan is still in jail, and another governor serving a term of, I think, 6 or 8 years on original assignment, probably will be out fairly soon. What went wrong with Blagojevich? Was it simply a matter of tremendous evil intent and tremendous criminal capacity or criminal ambition, or was he also rather stupid?
Well, he was rather stupid, but the problem was he came up partly and was trained in the culture of corruption in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
His first jobs were with Eddie Verdoliak's law firm, and then later as assistant corporation counsel for the city of Chicago. He only became a state legislator because his father-in-law, Dick Mell, was mad at Al Ronan, who had deserted the Mell's organization. And so Mell essentially anointed him as state legislator, and then he moved on to Congress. And as he moved higher and higher up, he began to have to raise more and more money. To run for governor in the state of Illinois now, you have to raise between $10 and $20 million. Blagojevich not only wanted to run for governor, he wanted to run for president of the United States. And as he began to look for schemes that would get him that money, he began to cross all sorts of laws that later led to his downfall. At least that's how I read it. I was telling David earlier that I ran into him even after he was indicted at a local restaurant. We both live in the Ravenswood neighborhood. And he was trying to just wait until I tell my side of the story. You'll understand that I'm perfectly, you know, legitimate in what I did, and I shouldn't be persecuted this way.
How did he raise or attempt to raise the money? How did he violate law as while raising the money?
Well, he had a sense of entitlement, a pure narcissism once he became governor. And he thought that anytime anybody wanted anything from him, they owed him something first. And so
it's pay to play.
That became what was known as pay to play.
Yeah.
If you listen to the tapes or if you knew anything about him, I never dealt with him directly in that capacity when I was with the speaker down in Springfield. But certainly that's what everybody was hearing, was that if you wanted a bill signed or a veto or any kind of particular action, he was always waiting for, what are you going to do for me first? It was just pure sense of entitlement. And he then surrounded himself with yes men, and everyone, you know, nobody would say to him, governor, you're not supposed to be doing this. So that's a wicked cocktail, to have that kind of narcissism and then have everybody around you tell you how great you are.
But is it not the case that lots of other governors, including prior governors of Illinois and governors of many other states, and mayors and important people who hold executive power in American political office, that lots of them do this sort of thing? They essentially impose a pay-to-play rule, but they do it in a more veiled way or more subtly or somehow with more wink and nod. Isn't it true that he wasn't so much a very special criminal as merely an inept criminal?
Both are true. First, the scale at which he dealt, and then the ways that he dealt. I mean, essentially, every board and commission in the state of Illinois was up for sale, and he put his henchmen on those boards. And for instance, in the pension funds, they controlled the decisions related to hundreds of millions of dollars of pension expenditure, including who the advisors would be. That was the same thing was true with many different boards, and so it wasn't just even a straight out one time bribe. It was a continual pattern of corruption that fed every part of the government. And some of them he wasn't directly involved in, but he put people there who were.
Yeah, I hope it's not true that everybody has done this in the past.
I didn't say everybody, but lots of people, I'm sure.
Well, there's an inherent tension in politics because people are going to give campaign contributions to people who support their positions, who do what they want them to do. And so you're always going to see that somebody who's pushing for something might contribute to somebody. And then, lo and behold, they do that. They take that official action, and someone says, well, that's because of the campaign contribution. You can cross a line, and honestly, nobody is entirely sure where that line can be drawn. That's one of the problems we have right now in politics. We don't know exactly what is permissible and what's not. I get asked that question all the time. I'm often not sure what to say. But what Rod Blagojevich did was a straight quid pro quo. I will not release this money for pediatric cancer unless I get a campaign contribution first. That kind of direct quid pro quo is clearly illegal.
It is indeed. And that was, you mentioned the one that was most offensive of all, because it was for the children's hospital.
Of course. And he was always telling everyone how he cared so much about children's health care.
We are about to pause for a quick update, or rather for a quick round of commercials. When we return, though, Richard, I want to go, one is never supposed to call you Richard. In fact, I think your legal name is Dick rather
it
than
is.
Richard.
My legal name is Dick. Only administrators call me
I've known that for
other
years,
name that isn't mine.
I sometimes lapse into that, as you know. On the basis of the data that you and your colleagues have compiled in a study that was published back in February and which got a lot of press attention nationally as well as locally.
And a lot of competition. Many states have challenged and said they're more corrupt than we are.
There we are. Well, you pronounced that ours was the most corrupt city in the country on the basis of the data available, and that probably Illinois was the most corrupt state in the country.
We're the third of the seventh, yes.
We want to look at the data just a little bit as we continue right after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And returning to David Ellis and Dick Simpson. A quick side note regarding David Ellis. As many listeners are already aware, I am sure, he is not merely a working lawyer, but also by now a very well-established novelist. And he's done some five or six in the genre that might be called legal thrillers. The most recently published is titled The Wrong Man. You got the Edgar for first mystery novel or first detective
That's
novel?
Right, best first novel.
Yeah.
Which is a tremendous honor.
Yeah, thank you. It was great, and it's been a great ride.
And we're not talking about these novels tonight, but we will mention them a few times at least.
But it's so bad in Illinois, it sounds like fiction.
Yeah. Now, back to Illinois and your conclusion based upon the data that you and your colleagues put together, that your conclusion that Illinois is the most corrupt, politically corrupt state in the nation, and Chicago clearly leads all the other cities.
Yeah, Chicago is very clear. In the state, we've had 1,848 convictions between 1976.
That's your basic data.
And 2010, and it comes from the Department
of to prison.
Number of people sent to prison by the Department of Justice for the crime of public corruption or political corruption. The city's metropolitan region, not just the city itself, has had 1,531, and that's clearly leading. When you look at
hold on, who's next after us?
I happen to bring the report so I can tell you. I have to look it up because we've compiled so much data anymore. In terms of states first, the District of Columbia and Louisiana lead us over Illinois, and we're usually ranked third. If you do it just in sheer number of convictions, New York and California, because they're larger lead us. In terms of the cities, we're first. Los Angeles is second. Manhattan, New York is third, District of Columbia is fourth, and Florida comes up number five in the Miami area. And in fact, Florida has challenged our findings and said the Florida Integrity Commission, which is trying to pass new ethics legislation in Florida, has said, well, that's old information, that's 76 to 2010. If you look at just the last decade, Florida has become much more corrupt than Illinois. And so we have a contest. In fact, when the report was released, I had discussions with media in New Jersey and in Boston and in Los Angeles. Many people were apparently they think it's a great prize if you're most corrupt in the nation.
Another very interesting number you came up with is that the cost to us in the city for political corruption runs to $500 million a year.
That's the best guess we can give.
How do you calculate a thing like
that? Well, we looked at what the out-of-pocket costs are. I'm not sure I can remember all of these. Again, we've looked at all these different convictions. But if you take the hired truck scandal, doing it from memory, there were about $42 million paid out for trucks that we didn't hire. So you say, well, the hired truck scandal cost us $42 million. That doesn't count the cost of prosecution. It doesn't count any of the court costs. And if you look more broadly at things like, for instance, I gave the example when we were off the air, the porch collapse in Lincoln Park. An inspector was bribed, porch collapse, 5 or 10 people are killed, college students who were celebrating their graduation. You're not taking into account the loss of life. You're not taking in a loss of faith and credit in the government. One of the reasons people don't like to pay taxes is they think the government just steals their money. There are lots of costs, but we think that the most conservative, reasonable estimate is $500 million a year that we could be using to fix some of the problems. I mean, the city had a $650 million debt last year that it had to close. They wouldn't have had to do any of it. Or the state has, depending on who you believe, $5 to $8 billion in structural deficit. We wouldn't have to have quite such a big structural deficit.
David Ellis, you've been associated with as a lawyer giving special service in the state legislature, particularly in the House. You've been associated with state government for some time and with the state legislature. I don't know whether there are any such workups with available data concerning corruption in the state legislature, but what do you have on that subject?
I don't have any data. I know that we have, from time to time, enacted reforms. We enacted some in 2002 and 3, and then certainly after Blagojevich's crimes were exposed, we spent a whole session with probably five or six major pieces of legislation.
Have you, from time to time, also lost particular members, whether House or Senate, to federal indictment and federal imprisonment?
It's pretty unusual at the legislative level. Of course,
there have been about 10 in both the House and the Senate in this time period because we had an inquiry from the Senate about it. So it's less than you would expect in the state legislature.
In which time period?
This 76 to 2010. Uh-huh. We've had about 10 of them.
So yeah, I mean, right now we have a state legislator who's under indictment by the federal government, but that's the first in the 6 years I've been here.
But governors are more likely to be indicted.
Four of the last seven have gone to prison.
Yeah. Of course, one of them went to prison for financial crime after his
term
of office.
That is correct, yes. Dan Walker was caught up in a savings and loan issue after he was governor. The other three were for their performance. But we have other very colorful figures like Paul Powell in our history.
With
in his shoeboxes.
Shoeboxes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and nearly $1 million in his hotel room shoeboxes that were
but
obviously
Paul,
bribes. He was Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, but he was never indicted. He died.
No, he died. He was not convicted.
But if he had lived longer, he probably would have been.
I don't know whether we would have ever caught him. It was very...
Different time.
Different time.
Different prosecutors.
Yeah.
What are all the different modes of true criminal political corruption? I know there's a shady area where you can say it's kind of illegitimate, but you can still get away with it because it's pinstripe corruption or legal corruption or quasi-legal corruption. But what's outright... in violation of law?
Well, the basic rule, of course, is you shouldn't be using your public office for private gain.
Yeah.
But when we looked at suburban corruption, we found six specific patterns. One was ties to organized crime, which are fairly well known. One is nepotism and patronage. One is police officers aiding criminals, kickbacks and bribes to public officials, large economic developments in which the officials and their families profit. Outright stealing of public funds. We had the very colorful case in Dixon, Illinois, of $53 million being stolen.
We had a colorful case some years ago in Cicero, did we not?
We have had
along
many.
Cicero
lines. Since 1920s when Al Capone moved there. But the one you're referring to is Betty Loren Maltese, who was involved in a $12 million scam related to insurance, improper money that was paid on insurance. In the town of Cicero.
We clearly, whether we are the leading state or the only ranking third and losing out to Florida, which is coming on fast, or Louisiana, which is coming on faster, we are clearly maintaining a culture of political corruption.
Yes, the basic problem is a culture of corruption, which is why no one single law will cure it. Many laws are helpful. Prosecution is helpful. But, for instance, just to give a few examples, we no longer teach civics in the public schools of Chicago. Mm-hmm. So we don't teach what are the, not just the mechanics of the three branches of government and that kind of stuff, but the real, how does government work? What is the cost of corruption? What's the cure of corruption? We've had now the state report from the Ethics Commission. We've had the city report under Mayor Emanuel. We've had now, this is our sixth report from the University of Illinois. It's not that we don't know some of the things we need to do about corruption, but we've been unwilling to do them comprehensively. It's going to take a decade or two. The shocking fact that I usually give is the first corruption trial in Illinois was 1869, when city council members of the city of Chicago and the county board members were involved in a very familiar kind of contract bribe. They got a bribe to do a contract for painting City Hall, which was wooden at the time, and they used whitewash, and it wiped off the next day, and everyone said, well, maybe something's wrong here, and they tried them. Four of them got sent to prison, and most of the other 14 lost their next election.
We need to look more deeply into all of this, including, of course, the question of, is reform possible? Chicago ain't ready for reform, we were told a long time ago by which?
Patty Baller.
Patty Baller. And he would probably say the same if he could join us tonight. But there are others who are aching for reform. There are others who are very aware that in the city of Chicago, we pay what has become an inordinate corruption tax. And that not only depletes our own minimum fortunes, it indicates that the city cannot really take care of itself and messes up, and a lot of basic services are going wrong. We see some evidence of special urban pathology in this town just over recent weekends with the murder rate. If we can't keep that in check, at least with more effective police coverage, and that means hiring more police, training them better, then that indicates that we're squandering our money, probably because it's going into too many private political pockets. We need to look further into this whole dreadful dilemma as we proceed, which we shall do directly after, an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return in a broad-ranging discussion about political corruption in the city and the state. And this city and the state stand for other cities and other states. Illinois is not unique in the country or the world.
But we're pretty unusual in the Midwest. If you go next door to Wisconsin, not so much Indiana, but if you go to Wisconsin or Minnesota...
Much cleaner.
Much cleaner. Yeah. They get horrified if there's a small bribe of $5 that's passed.
Well, then that leads to the obvious and necessary question, which I put to both of you. Let me put it first to David Ellis. Why are things so much less corrupt in, say, Wisconsin or Minnesota or wherever?
I'm not at all convinced that that's the case. I think one of the things that has been unique about Chicago for the last 10 years is the U.S. attorney we've had here. We've had a very aggressive U.S. attorney, a good man, as far as I know. I know him a little bit just from the Blagojevich saga, but he has made it a priority. He said when he came in that he was going to make it a priority. A lot of states don't focus on that. And I think that people cannot underestimate the importance of an aggressive federal prosecutor.
Others would say that the key to all of it is a strong Democratic machine or a strong political machine running the major city and running the state.
Well, it's true that machine politics breeds corruption, and I'll go back into why, but it's not just Democratic. DuPage County is Republican. And they have a Republican machine that's at least as rapacious and as bad, although I get lots of then calls from DuPage County protesting. But it's simply if you run a machine. And why is that? Well, in a machine, let's say you're working your precinct as a precinct captain. I go to Milt Rosenberg and I say, I want you to vote for Attila Hunt and his brothers. They're great people. And I'll keep my job. And you vote for them. You're getting favors like your tree trimmed or your kid out of jail or a job at the park district. I'm getting to keep my job for the city or the county or whoever has hired me in local government. That quid pro quo works with businesses on contracts and the rest. So there's been an exchange, an economic exchange, not a political exchange. I haven't gone to you and said Attila the Hun is really a capable guy and here's his platform. I've gone and appealed to you in base economic self-interest. And as you build that in, and then the precinct captain goes to work down at city government and someone says, I've got a problem with my parking ticket. Here's $50. Fix it for me. He gives a bribe to the clerk at the court, and it's fixed. How does he know the difference between he just traded favors out on the precinct or got his job as a patronage job as a favor for his political work? It's all built into a culture. And then the citizens expect, well, I'm supposed to give a bribe to the public official. And the public official expects I'm supposed to get something like Blagojevich we were talking about earlier. I'm supposed to get something if I'm going to sign this bill or make this appointment. Yeah. It's a culture that's built up over a century and a half. That's why it's so hard to change.
I've told the story before on the air, so I'll do a very, very brief version of it. In my first month in Chicago, which is way back in 1965, and I'd come down from the hills of New Hampshire where I was teaching at Dartmouth College, I was stopped by two cops in a car for some kind of violation on the, not on the outer drive, but rather on the Dan Ryan. They stood there for about half an hour trying to suggest to me that I ought to bribe them. Not saying it directly, but what do you want to do about it? And do you need to go to the station or can we work it out here? And I was so stupid, I didn't quite understand. And they finally gave up in disgust. They realized, I said, I just moved here from New Hampshire. They finally realized, with some real annoyance, that I didn't catch on. And rather than ticket me, they just drove on.
And this is, if you carry this through, you know, yes, in the old days, a good Chicagoan wouldn't know to wrap a $10 or $20 bill around their driver's license. But you don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Why do you not do it anymore? Yeah. Because if you do it, you're just as likely to be arrested on a corruption charge.
Yeah.
And so we've actually changed that little part of the culture of corruption since 1965 when it happened to you until the present day when someone would have to be really stupid to try and bribe a cop.
But when you talk about the culture of corruption, what about quasi-corruption or what about legal corruption? What about the big sweetheart deals that are worked out between politicians and contractors? Is that part of the problem, even though it doesn't show up in your data?
If they end up getting private gain from this particular public action, and they do it directly in a quid pro quo faction, it is still against the law. And
but if they get a lot of money into their campaign coffers.
As you were giving the example earlier, if it is just someone who, let's say it's a labor union and they agree and labor and the public official does something labor unions like and they give a campaign contribution, that may not be good, but it's not illegal and corruption in the strict sense.
But one of the things that you need to do, and we did this at the state level after Blagojevich, is we separated the governor from procurement. And so the governor can't give out big sweetheart contracts anymore in the state of Illinois. There are little, you know, silos set up around state government, depending on what the subject matter is, and that's where the money will exchange hands now in terms of contracts. The governor cannot control that like Governor Blagojevich controlled it, and procurement was how he made all his corrupt money.
There is a larger issue here concerning yet other important government officials, one of them being the man that you have worked for some years. As you certainly well know, this newspaper, the newspaper printed from this building, has been rather critical of Speaker Madigan over recent years, as have many others. I want to read to you, and this is just before we stop for some commercials, but after that I trust we might be able to discuss it. Here is something from an article by a former Chicago cop who is a self-elected observer of political corruption and writes for various blogs, and this is from the Washington Times, which printed his stuff. His name is Peter V. Bella, and this is just a small excerpt. He says, "Illinois is a reeking cesspool of bipartisan corruption. It is an evil empire run by one man. Madigan is a property tax attorney. While driving the state into bankruptcy and raising taxes on the populace, he makes millions of dollars from corporate clients, from major real estate developers and other moneyed power brokers by lowering property taxes on their commercial properties. Madigan assured his actions would never be investigated by electing his daughter, Lisa, as the Attorney General of Illinois. He controls the political appointments in that office. He is immune from state scrutiny. Even the United States Department of Justice leaves him alone. You have to understand something about corruption. There are three types: the obvious illegal corruption, ethical corruption, which may or may not be illegal, and the gray area in between, where the most sophisticated people ply their trade. In Illinois, that gray trade is a multi-lane highway. It is the Michael J. Madigan Tollway." I know you want to respond to that, and you will right after we pause for these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Well, I may have dropped a small bomb, or at least a small annoyance, but how can you talk about corruption in the state of Illinois without dealing with the accusations which have been leveled for some years about the Madigan regime? And many agree with the writer of that little piece I just read that essentially Madigan is the man with the most power in Springfield, or maybe in the state. How can you deal with corruption without confronting the fact that there have been many accusations about Michael Madigan? You've worked for him for some time, David. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he's a friend of yours. What's your response?
Well, I can tell you that when I left private practice in Chicago in 2006 to go down there, I wouldn't have gone down to work for somebody who I thought was corrupt, and I wouldn't have stayed down there if I thought he was corrupt. I've got my book writing and my private practice. I've got plenty of other things that I could do with my life than work for someone who's corrupt. I've heard all sorts of things in the Chicago Tribune and others. It's so funny to be a part of something up close and then to read about it from other people and to see how they will take something and twist it. It is true that the speaker is an attorney, has a private practice. You know, our state government was set up so that state legislators are part-time legislators. They're not paid very much money, and if you want to get anybody decent to be a state representative or a state senator on that salary, it's not going to happen. So by definition, virtually everybody who is down in Springfield has another job.
Does his law practice profit and flourish from the fact that he's got that crucial political command post?
I don't believe it does. I've
really?
Certainly seen nothing. Working very closely with him for 5 years, I've never seen any hint of a conflict of interest. Whenever he does think that there is a conflict, he declares one. He will, on his own, say, I think I have a conflict, or occasionally he'll ask me, what do you think? And we're always very cautious about declaring conflicts if there is one, and he'll abstain from something. But he does have a private practice, but he does not let that dictate what he does as speaker. In fact, I have seen many situations where people might think he would be giving favorable treatment to somebody where he actually does the opposite. There are whole industries down in Springfield that would say the Speaker Madigan is probably their least favorite representative because he's so tough on them. And yet probably some of them have some business with him otherwise. He would never do that. I just don't think that's how he wants to act. I mean, I know him much better personally than probably most people, and I just know he wouldn't do it that way. When he's down in Springfield, he's a tough politician, there's no question about it, but he's ethical to a fault, and he's a teetotaler. He calls me in all the time and says, here's a situation, do I do this or that? And I will give him my honest answer. I'm not a yes man. I'll say, do that. He'll do it. He'll follow what his attorney says. You know, some of what you said earlier, Milt, about Lisa Madigan, I mean, I almost had to laugh.
I didn't say it. I was reading
from Well, you were reading from it, sure. But, you know, and I read columnists in the Tribune talk about, you know, Lisa and her father. Nobody tells the attorney general who to hire. If you know her at all, you know that she is her own person and she answers to nobody but herself. And certainly when the attorney general has legislation that comes through, we are just as tough on that legislation, if not tougher, than other legislation. There's no favoritism whatsoever.
Dick Simpson, if you were here alone tonight and David Ellis was not and you hadn't heard what he's just had to say about the speaker, and if you came in somewhat earlier tonight and I put the question directly to you after you defined the extent and the range and the type of corruption which haunts politics in this state and city, if I asked you, what's your evaluation of Speaker Madigan, what would you have said?
Well, I would go about answering it the other way. There are also others like Alderman Burke and Joe Burrios, who's now the assessor. And the problem that begins to occur, and Alderman Burke, for instance, is also very careful with abstaining from votes on the council floor that relate to any of his legal representation. But the problem occurs is you've got people from one government essentially lobbying or appearing before another government. So, for instance, Joe Burrios, when he was head of the appeals board, which would determine property taxes, was lobbying in Springfield before Madigan, and vice versa. You have Madigan's law firm and Madigan appearing before Burrios and others here. We ought to have a simple rule that just simply says that officials from one government, unless they're representing their government, you know, if they're representing the state of Illinois or they're representing Cook County or they're representing the city council in their official capacity, yes, they should be able to lobby and be involved in transactions at the other level. I see it as a built-in conflict of interest. Alderman Burke, for instance, has more than $1 million in campaign funds from major corporations, legitimate ones, American Airlines, United, so forth. They vary back and forth each year on the list. Both hire his law firm and give him campaign contributions to represent them from property tax matters in the case of Burke, in the case of Madigan. But there are many other examples of this kind of crossing back and forth, representing private parties before governments, but where your clout or your political power is known. And we ought to simply have a rule. And if you're correct that state legislators are underpaid, aldermen are now paid rather well, at $108,000.
Yeah.
If we need to raise the pay for state legislators to keep them from having to have conflicts of interest, we ought to do it.
You know, I will say that the Tribune did a very careful study of the cases that the Speaker's Law Firm brought before Berrios and found there to be no heightened advantage, no higher rate of success, no evidence of favoritism at all. And I believe that those Tribune reporters opened every file and went through every single one of them. I understand what you're saying, but I think whether it actually has happened, I doubt that it's happened, although I understand what you're saying, Dick. And I think, in fact, the conclusion from reporters who were definitely trying to find something, they didn't find anything.
I'm told by a political informant, told just today when I was checking with him and consulting with him, I won't otherwise name him, but he's somebody that both of you probably would respect if I mentioned his name, that one thing that's happened a good deal down in Springfield is that the special pensions for legislators and particularly for executives in the state are very, very favorable. And Speaker Madigan has had a real role in increasing that pension level, which is advantages not only him, but many of his close colleagues. And that this maybe is legal, but is certainly a little bit on the nervous-making side all the same.
There have been several pension bills that have passed in the last several decades that have particularly advantaged individuals. There have been exposés in all the local presses about them. And the problem is that they're special deals. It's not because you worked to state government for 20 years and you get X dollars in pension. They're special deals related to particular individuals, sometimes almost written to where only one individual can be applied to.
Has Madigan had such a deal?
I don't know what Madigan's situation with pensions is.
I don't think so.
I don't know.
I mean, the Speaker has been a state representative
since the 70s. Yeah, he's been a state representative for so long. But there certainly have been pension legislation that have advantaged individual people in both local and state government in ways that are part of the howl for pension reform now.
Well, there's also been a raid upon regular state pension systems in which they've been depleted of their own funds.
We're badly funded. There's no doubt about it. And there are a whole series of reasons. And David's been part of the negotiations to try and solve it. It partly is historic. For instance, the collar counties and the others, the teachers didn't pay anything towards their pension. It was all picked up by the state. And so now they're trying to readdress that. And that's a big issue because if it's completely readdressed, the property taxes in the suburbs will go sky high, and therefore there's resistance. There's problems with whether employees like myself, I work for the state of Illinois at the University of Illinois, will have to pay more for our future pension, pay a different rate. Mm-hmm. And the problem is trying to work out the equity, and it's more than one issue involved. But the biggest single problem has been the unwillingness of the state to pay their share of the pensions for the last 30 years. As the pensions have gone up by state law, the state has not, every time they come to a budget, they say, well, let's borrow essentially from the pensions. What's a few hundred million dollars among friends? We'll just not pay $100 million, $200 million, $300 million this year. And then that means we don't have the investment. The employees have paid their share other than the suburban employees. But the pensions are underfunded because the state shorted the payments they should have made.
We've had data recently released on a national level reflecting and really establishing that Illinois is just about the worst state in the union, the worst of the 50 in terms of its fiscal situation. Does the problem and the pervasiveness of political corruption have anything to do with our being in such dire straits financially?
Only partly, but let me give one example. Yeah. Immediately after Blagojevich was indicted, the next bond issue put out by the state cost us $20 million in that bond issue alone, simply for our corruption reputation. There was nothing else at stake.
We were downgraded by the agencies.
We were downgraded, and we paid for it. And it was the only thing that had happened in between was the Blagojevich indictment. Now,
that was because Blagojevich was still in office, and there was and it was such a tenuous situation. They actually put a little codicil on their downgrade. And they said it's because we don't know what's going to happen. Is this guy even going to stay governor? The instability, which, bond markets don't like instability. I don't think it's because of political corruption. I think that the lack of funding of the pensions has been a big part of it, and I think that they have been overly generous. And then we have a constitutional provision in our state constitution, which once you've given something in terms of pensions, you can't take it back. And so it's sort of a one-way road sometimes. You can't put the car in reverse. We're trying to do that. We're trying to find something that we think the courts will accept, but that's one of the big problems we have right now.
What is the modus vivendi? What are you trying to establish?
Well, we're trying to right the ship. We're trying to come up with a pension system that will stay afloat for all these years. I mean, we don't want to curb benefits that people have been getting, but 70% of something.
What innovations are you considering?
Oh, well, we're talking about all sorts of things. We're talking about increasing the contributions. We're talking about changing the cost of living adjustment, the COLA that retirees get. We're trying to give – what we've been talking about recently is giving people a choice so that they can take they can keep what they have right now but not get health care when they retire, or they can take the health care option but in exchange for that maybe lower their COLA. The cost of living adjustment is a huge money number when it comes to pensions. And contributions is another thing. A lot of state employees and government employees in general don't contribute very much of their own salary to pensions.
It's true. It varies across.
It varies, sure.
You know, the average state employee contributes at least 8%, but it's what the other side, the employer, the direct employer does as well. But in the particular case of the suburban teachers, they didn't.
We are about to pause for the usual reasons. An update on the evening's news from Paula Kupfer. But before we go to the newsroom, here's what is in store for the second hour. We will go on with discussion here with Dick Simpson and David Ellis until the 11:15 break, and then we'll go directly to the phones and to the email. Therefore, if you are very eager to pose a question or make a direct comment, or for that matter, tell us a story about corruption that you have observed or to which you have been subjected, by all means, give us a call. And if you don't mind waiting for a few minutes, get in line.
And I would be particularly grateful if they would do examples of suburban corruption, since we have a press conference at 9:30 tomorrow morning.
By all means. Yes, to all the suburbs in Chicago. If you know anything about corruption in your suburb or in adjoining ones, do give us a call and tell us about it. You reach us, of course, at 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. And for email, if you're listening in Sydney, Australia, you want to tell us about how bad it is there. I learned only today, reading some stuff, that once Sydney was a very, very corrupt city.
And they changed, which is very helpful.
And they changed, as was Hong Kong, I think.
Yes.
Did I read that in your material?
Yes, my material. Those Sydney and Hong Kong are examples of places that did reform.
So I know we've got some listeners in Sydney. To reach us, of course, you do that via email, wherever you are in the country or world. If you want to reach us by email, the address extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 as one word at WGNradio.com, or for phones again, 312-591-7200, to the newsroom and Paula Kupfer.
It's Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
And we do look forward to contributions from our listeners in the form of questions or reports from the field, as it were, and reports about political corruption, whether in Chicago, whether elsewhere in the state, whether in the suburbs of Chicago, a special interest of Dick Simpson's at this very moment. Dick Simpson of the Political Science Department, UIC, being, of course, one of our guests, the other, David Ellis, who is a special counsel to Speaker Madigan, down in Springfield, and is as well by now a very well-established and highly regarded novelist in the general genre of legal thrillers. The newest one, and I haven't read it. It was handed to me yesterday. It looks like I might enjoy reading it. But the newest one is titled The Wrong Man. Take a minute to say what The Wrong Man is about.
The Wrong Man is a legal thriller in a series. It's about a defense attorney who defends an Iraqi war veteran who's accused of murder. He's suffering from post-traumatic stress. What starts out as a straight insanity defense turns into a search for the real killer and ultimately a terrorist plot in our fair city.
Gentlemen, a kind of a challenge to you. We've talked about corruption in Illinois and more broadly around the country, I suppose. But how do we do cross-nationally? Take a few other countries. Take a confused, disorganized, quasi-democracy heading always towards catastrophe and towards new totalitarianism waiting in the wings, Pakistan. Take a country like France, a long-established democracy, these days turning a bit socialist, but it will turn back again in the other direction. And let's add a third. For a third, a well-established country which is quasi-democratic, it's quasi-republic, but indeed it is a monarchy, one of the few monarchies where the kings still really matter, Thailand. Compared to Pakistan, France, or Thailand, how well do we do in this country with regard to control over political corruption?
Well, if you look at Transparency International, which ranks all of the countries, and I don't have that memorized, so I can't give you our exact standing, but we're in much better standing than places that I study, like Sierra Leone, which have considerable corruption at the national level.
Well, Sierra Leone hardly has a government.
No, it's got quite a good government since its civil war that ended in 2002. And it's making great strides. But in we're just finishing a book on development and democracy in Africa in post-conflict or post-war states. And corruption is one of several problems that they have to confront, and it's much worse than what we face. Nonetheless, I'm not very proud of the level of corruption we have in Illinois or Chicago.
There's probably an inverse correlation between the amount of public corruption and the freedom of the press.
That's one of the many checks, and the other good laws. And, you know, part of it goes back to this culture of corruption. You know, what's the pattern, what's the expectation that's built into the citizenry? And in a place like Pakistan, one expects to pay bribes, and likewise in Thailand. France, I'm less, I don't know how we compare directly on the transparency.
I had a guest here only about a month ago who was a very well-established major faculty member at the University of Chicago, indeed an economist. With business school connections. He's an Italian by origin. He had his earlier education in Italy, got a graduate degree, I think, in this country. And he won't go back to Italy because everything is corrupt.
Yes.
In his book, he writes about how just to get an ordinary job working as a medical orderly, you have to know a politician and you have to cross his palm with considerable silver. And that it's understood. And for a doctor to get an appointment doesn't depend upon a good hospital appointment does not depend upon his training and his demonstrated skill as a physician, but again upon whether he can be properly bribed or whether he's got friends with influence who will use that influence for him. Total corruption, yet the country goes on. And they've got a free press in Italy, though indeed he does point out that, what's his name?
Berlusconi.
Controls much of the press.
He used to own most of the press.
And owns most of the press.
Particularly the television.
But what do we make of a thing like that? Why should Italy, which is still, after all, a democratic state, they rotate their governments every now and again. It's a parliamentary system. Why would corrupt? I think corruption is higher there than here.
It is.
Why?
And you're correct. You mentioned sort of in passing totalitarian states. Russia, when it was totalitarian and a single country, was more corrupt than we were. And scholars who look at this make a distinction between the kind of corruption that's bureaucratic direct corruption just to get a permit to do something, and the other higher levels of corruption.
Well, the term that sticks now for Russia is that it's a kleptocracy.
Yes.
Most of the major government-owned industries were privatized and were stolen by people who had some
clout.
Advantage
in
the Communist Party.
Yeah, as we'd say here, they had clout.
They had clout, whatever the Russian word for clout is.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly right. But again, in totalitarian regimes, the press isn't able to speak about these things. The more these things can be kept quiet, the easier they can.
Well, the Russian press has talked about them at times, and one consequence is occasionally they kill a reporter.
Sure, absolutely.
These days,
yeah,
in democratic Russia, or supposedly democratic Russia.
So corruption is endemic, but the thing that we've learned is it is possible to cure it. We were giving examples of Hong Kong and Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
There are other examples.
What happened in Hong Kong and Sydney?
I still haven't delved into it fully because I've been so occupied in trying to keep track of our level of corruption. But essentially, you get a new government that comes in and they decide that that's going to be what they're going to do. And they set about systematically to enact new laws and to enact a new standard.
What kinds of laws do it?
No one, but they usually involve transparency, making the information more available. So there are more checks and balances by citizens and by media. They usually involve higher penalties for corruption, and it's setting a sort of higher standard in the government itself. The thing about corruption is there's no one silver bullet. In the various anti-corruption reports that I mentioned earlier, the state, the cities, and ours, we have anywhere from 50 to 100 specific recommendations, but they have to be done as a group. You have to set the tone rather than a specific
review change. What some of the most important are.
Well, besides electing public officials that are honest and have a reform agenda and carry it out, teaching civics again in the proper way about corruption in the public schools, they're very specific ones. The contracting ones you mentioned earlier are among the most important because there's a lot of corruption in the contracts that government led, and there are billions of dollars at stake. Changing the campaign contributions, which is another means in which often you have ways. Making sure that the law is as impartial as possible in zoning and in property taxes and those kinds of areas. That's just the beginning point. Like I say, it's not that we don't know what to do. It's that we don't do it with a continued effort over a long period of time with continued leadership.
What would you add to that list, David?
Well, I would add independent oversight and as much sunlight as possible. I think that Dick sort of alluded to that, although I would have to disagree with Dick about the campaign contribution limits. My own personal view from having seen us try to enact some reforms and see how they result, money is always going to get there one way or the other. As long as you have a First Amendment governing the use of money, and we had the Citizens United case from the United States Supreme Court, which was sort of a natural outgrowth of everybody trying to push down the balloon, and ultimately something was going to pop up somewhere. Money is always going to get to the candidates one way or the other. I would agree that to the extent that you don't allow people who get contracts with the government from making campaign contributions, which is the law we passed that really stopped Rod Blagojevich, that is crucial. But I don't think – I think we put too much hope in campaign contribution limits. I think it's independent oversight and sunlight.
Gentlemen, with that, we pause for the usual reason. A quick round of commercials, and then on to the phones and to the email. And once again, Dick Simpson has requested particularly things you've got to report about corruption in the suburbs of the city of Chicago.
Yeah, we found 130 convicted individuals. I'll be interested if they've got some new stories.
We don't have. Got some new ones for you. But you don't have to be reporting on suburban corruption to give us a call. A question or comment, get in there quickly, 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. And for email from wherever, the email address, extension 720 at wgnradio.com. Get your contributions in now. We'll be with you instantly, that is to say, in 3 minutes.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And with that, we will go directly to the phones in just an instant. At the moment, all the lines are taken, of course, at 312-591-7200. But if you hit the busy signal, don't be totally discouraged. Just call again right after we say goodnight to a prior caller. And coming up is the first caller. That is Mike. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. I wanted to get Professor Simpson's take on the bike contract. The city gave out a bike rental contract to an out-of-state company whose one of their principals came and worked for Commissioner Klein and helped write the request for bid. What isn't known and what wasn't reported was the out-of-state company never had any city business licenses. They didn't have a legal way to operate here. So the contract was rescinded. They applied and received their licenses, and then they were awarded the contract again without rebidding.
Well, yeah, it was reported in the media at the time that it happened. It's hard to evaluate how much there is this conflict. It's always more desirable not to have someone who's worked for a company be the one to write the RFP. And it's worth having it further investigated. My hope is that it'll still be a good decision from the city to begin to do more with the biking.
Do you think we have any chance of investigations of these as long as we have Lisa Madigan and Anita Alvarez as our prosecutors?
Well, I've been critical of both the state's attorney and the attorney general's office for not investigating more vigorously even more egregious cases of political corruption. I think both offices need to do more. I'm particularly hoping that the attorney general may become involved in suburban corruption cases, because there is there no one who is doing the job. With the state's attorney in Cook County, I would like to see her more involved in prosecuting all of the corruption cases. We can't just leave it to the U.S. Attorney's Office. There are 1,200 governments in the area of the metropolitan region that have the power to tax, and we found a lot of scandals that have been there. We need more investigative power, not just the city of Chicago, but throughout the region.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for a valuable call. 312-591-7200. I now see two lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, get in there quickly and somebody will get through. At 312-591-7200, Carl is next. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. I think the Tribune has done a great job on its editorial page of identifying these corruption and these various activities. But I don't understand how these folks keep getting reelected. How do we break the cycle?
That's an excellent question.
Well, essentially, you have to have people run on a platform of reform and then carry it out. Rod Blagojevich ran on a platform of reform, but he didn't carry it out. And they can be from either party. One of the problems is raising sufficient funds to be able to run successfully. To run for governor, you need $10 to $20 million. To run for Congress, you have to raise more than $1 million. To run for alderman these days, you usually have to raise in the vicinity of $250,000 or more. I personally favor, and we do in our reports, public financing to make those campaigns more affordable. There's still checks and balances involved in public financing, but Maine and other places have successfully used public financing.
There's another less costly way to become governor of the state of Illinois. Hook on to the ticket and get yourself nominated as lieutenant governor, and then hope that David Ellis or somebody like him will come along to lead an impeachment proceeding the state Senate and get rid of the present governor.
That's right. But and, you know, Dick makes the good point, though, that Governor Blagojevich ran on a platform of reform. I mean, the man was elected a second time. And at the time that he was elected, he outspent Judy Bartapinka probably 10 to 1. But the vultures were already circling. I mean, the federal prosecutors had already indicted a number of his very close allies. And people, for some reason, turned a blind eye to this. They didn't seem to care. I mean, the electorate does have to, you know, share some responsibility here. Money is a problem, but the people did cast their votes for him.
What was the role in the original election of Rod Blagojevich, of the man who later distinguished himself by buying a garden plot which he presented to Senator Barack Obama?
Tony Resco,
I mean Tony Resco, who's still languishing.
Tony Resco was an important fundraiser in all of the Blagojevich campaigns, including the first one. There really isn't. He also funded a lot of other people, and Barack Obama is one of them, which got campaign contributions. But it was most egregious in cases like Blagojevich, because he then became the go-to man to which all or most of the political appointments to commissions, boards, and other contracts in state government, they were all run through Tony or Chris Kelly. There was the other one who since committed suicide. He was at the center of the plots that were run by the Blagojevich administration, by Rod Blagojevich, to raise the campaign money and to go on. Hopefully, he hoped to run for president.
Yeah, his greatest influence was once Rod became governor. It was while he was in there, and he was one of the guys with the levers to the power, no question.
What do you know about his relationship to the man who aspired to and achieved the presidency of the United States?
I don't know very much about it. Obviously, what you just alluded to, Milt, he did raise money for a lot of people who he saw as up-and-comers. He was a political opportunist all along, I think. There's a number of people, I think, it turned out, that back when Resco was first indicted, I think someone pulled up all of his list of campaign contributions, and they were numerous.
And to some extent, they were mostly Democratic, but there were some Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Back to the phones. 312-591 7200, and next up is Jerry. Good evening.
Thank you. There's an interesting video on YouTube that I watched not long ago where our fine Senator Charles Schumer was speaking to at a Jewish synagogue wearing a yarmulke and speaking to his Jewish synagogue, telling all of his people not to worry about Barack Obama because Barack Obama's political career in Chicago was financed by Chicago's richest Jews. These are the words of Schumer himself in speaking to the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
And have you noticed? And now we have Rahm Emanuel, the dual Israeli citizen and mayor of Chicago. So it just seems to be at the heart of the corruption. You know, in the old days, we used to think, you know, the Chicago mob, you know, was Al Capone and the Italians. But it seems today like things are a little different. Don't you agree?
I guess you're suggesting that the real force behind American politics these days is a Jewish conspiracy of very, very rich Jews. Certainly some of them did play a role in the Obama campaign. Penny Pritzker here in Chicago was supposed to have had a major role in raising money. She bundled at a very high level. But I think I will resist the implication of the protocols of the elders of Jewish Chicago.
Yes, it's true that people with money play an important role, I think. And we've seen that in Mayor Daley and in Rahm Emanuel and Barack Obama and anybody else who's very successful in running for higher office. Money does have an immense influence, but it's not particularly by ethnic group.
I do fault the Jews, an ethnic group to which, of course, I belong as well, for only one thing, particularly the rich ones. And that is that they are so intractably committed to the Democratic Party, when indeed they ought to be more open to examining the possibility that Republicans would serve their interests, if there are group interests at all, and one group interest supposedly is the fate and the future of Israel. The Republicans might very well be serving that interest better, or a Republican administration might, than the present administration. That's arguable, of course. There has been some decline, according to the polls, in the still majority of Jews in this country who favor the Democrats universally and in favor of the current president.
And it's likely to continue into the November election.
Surely, yeah. We are about to pause. Right after, I invite more telephone calls. We've now got a number of lines available. I want my friends to get in there quickly with good questions or with good comments. And good means just pertinent to the matter we've been discussing, which is political corruption, most particularly in our own neighborhood, both city and state, and more broadly as a phenomenon which besmirches and otherwise bedevils governments in other states and, for that matter, to be sure, in other countries. 312-591-7200. The number is the lines are open. Get your calls in instantly if you've got anything to say or to ask. 312-591-7200. And we go back to the WGN newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our guests tonight have been and continue to be David Ellis, special counsel to Speaker Madigan in Springfield, and a man who is now making a large reputation for himself as the author of legal thrillers. The newest one is titled The Wrong Man, and it is published by Putnam. You're in the tradition most immediately of Scott
Turow.
Turow.
Yeah, good friend of mine and my literary hero.
I can see that he would be.
Yeah.
Our other guest, of course, is Dick Simpson, a professor of political science, chairman of that department at the University of Illinois Chicago, and his research group has been doing very significant work examining corruption in Illinois, in Chicago, and you're branching out to look at other states in the country and ultimately other countries in the world.
Yes, we try and keep track of at least what's happening in the other places.
What country is likely to be the most corrupt in all the world?
Oh, I can't even remember now, but like I say, if people are really interested, go to the Transparency International website. Yeah. They rank them, and fortunately, we're not number one in the country as countries.
Yeah. What might be the most honest country in all the world with regard to public?
They tend to be Western European countries, tend to be the ones that the least corrupt. Mm-hmm. But countries can change their ranking, which is the good news.
Well, yeah.
By usually enacting laws and electing different people and changing the culture that they've had.
We go back to the phones. Some room available still on the board, 312-591-7200. Bob is next. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. How are you this evening?
Just fine, sir. Go ahead.
Excellent. Speaking as a former Illinois resident and a current Wisconsin resident, I would posit that the state of Wisconsin kind of is not as squeaky clean as it used to be in the last few years, especially considering the recall of Scott Walker and the investigation into his time as the Milwaukee county executive.
Well, explain that a little bit more fully. He exemplifies purity of political purpose or the possibility of corruption? Which are you asserting?
The possibility of corruption. I believe that the state of Wisconsin, in particular, in the governor's office at the moment, is experiencing more corruption in the last 4 years or so than has been the case in the past.
How do you support that assertion?
Well, looking at all of the things that have gone on here in the state with the protests and that sort of thing, and then, of course, with the recall election and that kind of thing, and the implications of linking Walker to the Koch brothers and others, it just seems like this is not something that has been as prevalent in the past in Wisconsin as it is currently.
You mean he's got support from some rich people?
Oh, I think he's got some very large support, sir, from some very rich, very unethical people.
The Koch brothers being exemplifying that characterization.
Exactly. Yeah,
what are known as the super PACs, but that's really very different from the kind of corruption we've mostly been talking about, essentially where a bribe is paid for public policy.
And what do we do about the fact that George Soros made very heavy contributions to the attempt to unseat the governor?
I would not say that the Democrats are necessarily any better.
All right. So a plague on all their houses. Thank you, sir, for the call. 312-591-7200. And next we go to Mary Ann. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Just fine.
I have a question in that, do you think that the rise in non-denominational churches in the area, meaning Chicagoland and outlying areas, has anything to do with the rise in people being frustrated with the sense that they just want part of corruption and they just want to find a loophole so that they can become rich on the side with this?
What does that have to do with non-denominational churches? I don't get the hypothesis.
Well, my thought is that there's a rise in these number of churches, and there takes probably about 12 elders to be on the board of directors for these churches. And so the money's coming in for these churches. I'm not quite sure if how well that is monitored by the IRS, and I'm sure their books can be squeaky clean, but then they can have things. The wealth of all of those people are becoming, you know.
I don't know. This one confuses me. Do either of you understand the nature of this accusation?
Oh, it's not an accusation. I'm just wondering if there's a way that that can happen. There's never an accusation in this. It's just a
hunch.
Yes, it's something that itches at the back of my neck when I see all of these churches around. And it's like, wow, another one popped up.
Well, I wish I fully understood this because I don't know what that has to do with that connects to political corruption.
Yeah, I don't think there's a direct connection. It's certainly true that you can have illicit churches, but that isn't the common practice. Most of them are legitimate, whatever their beliefs are, and most of them do not get involved in direct bribes to public officials to get public policy. There are some cases where religious groups will back political figures and their political parties, but that's fairly rare also.
Here's an interesting email that's come in, and I'll read it in just a moment after I say that we've got a number of lines open for phone calls, and I want you to get in there quickly if you've got something interesting to say or an interesting question to pose. 312-591-7200. Listen to this. What does your panel think of the recent selection of Governor Mitch Daniels as the new president of Purdue University by the Board of Trustees, whose members were either appointed or reappointed as trustees by the governor himself?
Well, I mean, that's what we've been talking about here to some extent. When you've got this interrelationship, you'd like to think, I suppose, I didn't know who picked him, but I'm not surprised that's how he was chosen. You'd like to think there could be some kind of a corralling of the two things, and so the selection process could be independent. But sometimes you can't, though. I mean, sometimes in government you have to have somebody appoint somebody else. And you just have to hope that there's as transparent a process as possible, I guess.
I'm always curious about the appointment of college presidents and chancellors that so frequently they're appointed for their ability to raise money and not their academic acumen.
It's a rare thing for a college president to become president of the United States, but it has happened at least twice. You can name them both.
Woodrow Wilson is the most obvious one.
And?
I forget the second.
A fellow named Eisenhower.
Forgot that he was a college president. I think of him as General Eisenhower.
Of Columbia University. We pause for a last round of commercials and then right back to the phones and to the email. And so once again, the phone number, 312-591-7200. There's lots of opportunity now. If you want to get in on the phone lines, move quickly. And for email, extension 720 at WGNradio.com.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to David Ellis and to Dick Simpson and to your calls for them on 312-591-7200. Next up, Mark joins us. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Isn't it disingenuous for people like Speaker Madigan and Alderman Burke to suggest that because they recuse themselves from votes involving their clients that they're free of a conflict of interest? And whether they vote on a particular issue is rather immaterial if their colleagues know the way Alderman Burke or Speaker Madigan would like them to vote.
A good point. Succinctly and in a challenging way.
I think that's giving a little too much credit to Speaker Madigan if you think that the entire House of Representatives first waits to see if something benefits Speaker Madigan before they act. There are thousands of pieces of legislation floating around at any time. And
well, considering he payrolls a lot of their campaigns, you'd think they'd be very attentive to what Mr. Madigan might want.
Well, if he were so inclined to tell him, I suppose, but if it were something that for which he had a conflict of interest, he wouldn't. He wouldn't tell them.
If they knew
if
they knew that the company involved is also a client to Madigan's law firm, might that not influence the way they vote?
I don't even know how they would know that. I don't even know who most of his clients are. I mean, it's a nice story, but it's not what happens.
Well, it's kind of hard to believe that these people aren't smart enough to put two and two together. And I would think that people around Mr. Madigan, and you know him, so you know I don't, so obviously you know him better than I do, you'd think that he would have ways of letting people know who he's working for. I mean, sometimes it's even in the paper. I mean, the Tribune and the Sun-Times do exposés on who his clients are. And unless we're assuming the legislators can't read, they must know who's hiring Michael Madigan. And in the city council, who hasn't hired? What major corporation in the city hasn't hired Ed Burke for some kind of work or Mike Madigan for some kind of work?
Well, all I can tell you is what I see down there, and I don't see people having those kinds of conversations. It's a nice story to tell. It's not what happens. And as for what you see in the Tribune, I've seen many times them try to put two pieces of information together and act as if that turns something into a scandal. But a lot of the things that they've talked about, I've seen firsthand, and it's just not the way. It's a nice story to tell, but it's not what happened.
Well, on a further issue on the Tribune, one of you made a point, it must have been you, that said that people who hire Mr. Madigan or Mr. Burke for property tax appeals don't get any better results than people who hire anyone else. But who cares? I mean, those people aren't hired to get – they're not – people don't hire Ed Burke and Mike Madigan because they want better results on their property tax appeals. They hire people like Mike Burke and Ed Madigan to win some influence with Mike Burke, with Ed Burke and Mike Madigan on whatever legislation they're interested in.
Really? Well,
I can hire you or I can hire Mike Madigan, right?
Okay, well, that's nice to say, but it does not happen that way in Springfield. I can't speak for Alderman Burke. One way or the other, I hardly even know him, but that's not what happens with Speaker Madigan. It doesn't work that way.
Let's get the views from Dick Simpson on that.
I still think we need to have a better rule that prevents any thought that there's a conflict of interest. And it's easy enough to figure out what that rule would be. It's just it's not advantageous to a number of politicians. We've talked about Mike Madigan and Ed Burke, but there are others who have the same conflict.
State that rule again.
Well, it's simply that you can't represent private parties before other governments. Yeah, you can represent your own if you're appealing for more money for the city. Yes, you can go down and lobby in Springfield for it, even if you have political connections, and vice versa. If you work for the state of Illinois, you shouldn't be lobbying the county for special favors or special arrangements related to property tax. It's not that hard to figure out what the law would look like. It's very hard. I can't imagine at the moment being able to get the votes to pass it.
Well, Sarah, thank you, gentlemen.
All right. We thank you for the call. Good and significant challenge, I would say. 312-591-7200. David joins us. Good evening.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg and guests. I'm going to follow back on the Wisconsin story because I believe the caller previously who spoke of it really didn't direct the issues properly. I'm looking more at the 13 people as of present who have been given immunity in the John Doe investigation, stemming out of possible campaigning on state county resources in Milwaukee and how that may have grown into being more of a state case. So my question for the guests is this. In terms of judging by metrics of previous governors that have been prosecuted in Illinois, how many John Doe investigate, or how many, should I say, how many immunity grants were given in the Blagojevich case as well as in previous prosecutions, and how long did it take from the time of the initial John Doe investigations until charges were brought against the governors?
David Ellis.
Oh, there were a handful of people who got immunity in the Blagojevich investigation. Not very many. It's usually the people who got on the bus first. In terms of how long it takes for these things, they usually take several years. And you may recall that the things that Governor Blagojevich was being investigated for, really most of them were not ultimately the subject of his prosecution. What ended up being the subject of his prosecution were all the things that they captured in that 30-day window of time on his phone calls and in his private meetings.
But they built up to being able to get the wiretap by being able to show this pattern of corruption with all of the associates of the governor. So they did work up the ladder, and it was a 3 or 4 year process mm-hmm. to be able to carry through. So if you're waiting in Wisconsin for the end of this investigation, you may be several years away.
And that is exactly why I brought that up, because I believe that there's still maybe not a long wait, but certainly some time left as the prosecutors and the other investigators are compiling their evidence and speaking with the witnesses.
We thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Interesting contribution. And on to the next, that next being Pat. Good evening. You're on the air.
Well, my thought is again, Wisconsin, but it isn't just Wisconsin. It's the corruption in the judiciary. Three of the Supreme Court justices in Wisconsin have been censured or are in the process, in Prosser's case, of being asked questions about his behavior. And I'm concerned that throughout the country there seems to be a lack of cleanliness in the judiciary, and are you finding that to be the case?
Our case in Illinois, the great one, was the Gaylord investigation, and I don't have it right completely.
About 10 or 12 judges went to prison.
There were about 12 judges, or at least 14 or 15 court personnel. There were bailiffs. There were lawyers. One judge was involved in fixing a case, a murder case. It was quite
for a big fee of $500.
Yeah, well, we have our standards in Chicago. Yeah. Most aldermen have gone to jail for taking zoning bribes in the $500 range. So we had the entire judiciary. I think it was fair to say, at least at the time of Gaylord, we had the most corrupt judiciary in the country, although, again, Louisiana comes very close. Since then, there's been some improvement in the judiciary, and we've not had another scandal anywhere near as great as the Gaylord scandal of the 1980s.
Well, I'm just concerned throughout the country that we see a little more not arm's length between corporatism and corruption in the judiciary.
I think that's a worthy goal that we should aspire to.
And you're also starting to see a lot more money going into the elections.
One of the biggest problems is you're now seeing corporations with very specific cases that they're looking at pouring millions of dollars into judicial campaigns. And the famous one was in West Virginia, and of course the one in Illinois downstate. And then you've got the trial lawyers and the medical profession fighting over tort reform and pumping millions of dollars into races again to affect the outcome of cases in that judicial jurisdiction. And in my view, the first step we ought to do in Illinois and other states is to, if we're going to do public funding anywhere, we ought to public fund the judicial races so that money is no longer such a powerful influence in those.
Our thanks to that caller. Here's something interesting that's come in via email, and this fellow's coming to our aid with regard to that caller who confused us about non-denominational churches. Mike from Oak Park says, many politicians speak about, quote, faith-based initiatives and faith-based programs and efforts. The faith-based groups receive 501c3 tax status or another favorable status, and the politicians receive their votes and support. That earlier caller may have been suggesting something along these lines regarding churches.
Yeah, I think the other caller was just confused.
Well, I mean, and sometimes when money is being given out through appropriations and grants, there will be some grants to religious institutions. There are some grants to Jewish institutions on the north side for busing, for example. And some people will argue about whether money should be going, you know, for secular versus non-secular purposes. You sometimes see that. Some people get upset about that. Sometimes they file lawsuits.
Let's take a last call. This is from Ken. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering if any, what thoughts the panelists had on how we can have real election reform after Citizens United, which basically says, you know, corporations can dump money into judicial campaigns, gubernatorial campaigns or any campaigns.
Yeah, that's good. It comes rather late in the program, but it is of some interest. Does the Citizens United decision increase the possibility for corruption or at least for undue influence?
Citizens United is essentially an outgrowth of everybody trying to regulate how spending happens. And ultimately what Citizens United said is, look, if you just want to spend money but you're not affiliated with somebody, you can spend money in this country. You can have speech. It's a free speech decision. And people get upset about it because of how it's misused and the loopholes that it seems to create for people. But in truth, all the case said was, if you're not affiliated with somebody and you just want to spend money on a message, you should be able to do it.
Yeah, my own sense, one of the efforts, and in fact, I think Joe Moore is announcing tomorrow a resolution in the city council to support a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. That may be the only way. There may be some legislative ways at the national level to find ways around the court decision. It is tricky, and it is a considerable problem because it is obvious from the current elections. There's too much money pouring in from outside sources. And, yes, they may not be having direct conversations with the candidates. But the other thing is they're mostly spent these huge monies from the super PACs are mostly spent in negative ad attacks. It's not improving the level of debate and discussion. It's worsening it.
We come almost to the end of the available time. Is there something about politics in this country that attracts the wrong sorts of people or rouses ambitions of the wrong sorts of people?
Well, ambition and greed are natural human desires, and so you're always going to have it to some extent. But we did have, at least with some of the founding fathers and others, a sense of citizen statesman, where your main goal was to serve the public and not just to enrich yourself. And that spirit we can appeal to, and we can find ways to encourage.
But even in that bunch, we had Aaron Burr.
We did. So you can have traitors, which is what Aaron Burr was directly called, in the sense that he was trying to overthrow the government. But you didn't have many Aaron Burrs. You had many more examples of Washington and Jefferson, and they all had failings. I'm not saying they were perfect human beings, but at least on the scale of corruption, They had a different sense of their public service.
Did you ever see the book, meant seriously, titled George Washington's Expense Account?
No.
Some guy worked it up years ago, saying that he really padded the account.
Nothing like what we do in Chicago or the suburbs.
I'm sure.
I can tell you that the vast majority of elected officials in Springfield are trying to do the right thing most days.
I'm sure that is true.
Yes.
Our guests have been David Ellis, special counsel to Speaker Madigan, and author of a fine series, I am told, I've not yet read them,
I'm the mysteries. One who told you.
You told me, among others, of legal thrillers. The newest one, The Wrong Man, and old friend Dick Simpson, chairman of the Political Science Department at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And you're doing a press conference tomorrow.
Tomorrow at 9:30, we're announcing the full results of our study of suburban corruption, and we're hoping that people will take action to eliminate it in the future. Mm-hmm.
So it's for the press, not for the general public, but they'll be reading and hearing about it.
If anybody wants to come, we'll be at the front of the county building at 118 North Clark Street.
Very good. And with that, it is indeed time to close shop. Do check out our website, extension WGNradio.com/extension720. A lot of new podcasts up there, including by tomorrow afternoon, this very program. We'll be with you again tomorrow night at 11 rather than 10. Until then, a most cordial good night to all.